Memory Box, written by Mark McNeese, produced and narrated by Wondervox AI. Her name is Risa. She turned 7 in February, which was 3 months ago. She knows it was 3 months ago because that's when her father John died, and because she hears her mother say it all the time when chatting to one of her many friends. It's been 3 months since the bastard died. Or, you'd think after 3 months. Risa doesn't know what anyone thinks after 3 months. She hasn't asked. She knows what she thinks, and she keeps it to herself, having learned that secrets are among the few things in life of true value. She lives in a one-bedroom apartment on 19th Street, 5 floors above a pet shop whose owner hates animals. Her mother, Irene, tells people who'll never see their apartment that it's a townhouse, though Risa has heard it referred to as a tenement. She asked Irene once if this is what it was, to which Irene replied, "They don't make tenements anymore. Besides, poor people live in tenements. Do we look like poor people to you?" Risa wondered afterward what the difference was between a tenement, which they didn't live in, and a dump, which Irene called their home in her more sour moods. There is no elevator in the building. For Risa, it's a case of not missing what she's never had. And despite the occasional rape in the stairwell, she enjoys climbing a good set of stairs. She also thinks they make for better neighborhoods, as everyone runs into each other going up 2, 3, 4 flights of stairs. It's hard not to be nice when you're winded, or at least too busy working on the next breath to be hostile. This is something Risa has noticed. She notices things, gestures and sayings and facial expressions, and puts them on file in her memory box, a sort of recipe index for human behaviors. Someday she may need one of them, a smile in a tight situation or a cliche to keep a conversation going, and she'll have it. She wishes people would stay put more. She and her mother and her father, who died 3 months ago, have lived in the same apartment for 4 years. That's a long time. Risa doesn't remember much before it, flashes and snippets of dialogue, the time when her grandmother's hair caught fire when the plastic lighter she used for her cigarettes exploded. But to recall in any great detail? No, not much until they moved here. Not even where they lived before. Somewhere in New Jersey. Newark, which is not New York by any means. They had a small front yard then, she remembers that. But there'd been some conflict with the neighbor over poisoned cats, and she wasn't allowed to play outside. Her father was afraid of the neighbor, a fat man who seldom shaved and who drank malt liquor for breakfast. He might offer Risa a piece of candy or a milkshake laced with strychnine, and by the time they got her to the emergency room, it would be too late. So all in all, Risa felt stable in their home on 19th Street. It was the departure of her friends and acquaintances that disturbed her. She'd just get to know someone, say, in the apartment off the 3rd floor landing, and a few months later, the apartment would be empty. Oscar, the super, would be working on a light fixture or throwing on a new coat of cheap white paint. Risa would notice him on her way out one day and poke her head in. "Where'd Mrs. Rodriguez go?" she'd say, not to mention Mrs. Rodriguez's retarded teenage son and the dog she kept against the rules. "Gone," Oscar would say, and shrug, his back to her. She never got any more explanation than that. Occasionally, there were rumors, but nothing solid. People just went, and Risa imagined herself taking a crosstown bus someday to a building she'd never seen before in the East 30s, walking through the front door and discovering with a sense of shock and satiated curiosity where everyone had gone. Her father died on a Tuesday between 5 and 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Risa knew the time because his favorite show, I Love Lucy, was in syndication twice a day at 5 and 5:30. She left to keep Mrs. Baker from 209 company in the basement laundry room. Mrs. Baker let her fold the clothes. Risa loved the smell of fabric softener on warm towels. She'd gone downstairs just after Lucy Ricardo, in a Superman costume, inched her way out on the narrow window ledge of their sitcom apartment. She clearly remembers her father laughing, the last thing about him she does remember, a distinctive laugh that reminded her of a cartoon donkey. But when she got back, Oscar was outside the apartment with a large Irish cop. Oscar turned Risa away and marched her back downstairs, telling her her grandma Evie was coming from Queens to take her away for a few days. "Where's my dad?" she said, trying to get loose from Oscar's grip. Gone. Just like that. Just like Mrs. Rodriguez and the O'Connors before that, and Jerry, the very nice gay man who died before that. Her mother, of course, was not gone. Her mother was in the apartment they wouldn't let Risa enter. Maybe she was looking for her father, under the bed, or outside on the ledge with the pigeons Irene was always chasing away. In any case, it was top secret. And now she was being whisked away in a cloud of Camel cigarette smoke to Grandma Evie's house. 35 minutes on the E, transfer to the F, something like that. She didn't remember exactly because she hated going there. Not so much because she hated Grandma Evie, it was a sin to hate anyone, but because, well, she just felt so sad there. Evelyn Mills, Risa's grandmother, smokes 2 packs of Camels a day. The walls in her house, although it is a pretty house with 2 stories and a front and backyard, are yellow from tobacco. Risa thought it was the color of the paint until she saw Violetta, Evie's housekeeper, washing the woodwork one day, and the yellow came off on the rag she was using. Violetta does not smoke, and sometimes wears a mask over her face if Evie is chain-smoking. It is not lost on Risa, the things people do for money. She thinks it must be hard, having to put up with something you don't like just because you have a family to take care of. Evie, on the other hand, does not put up with anything. She thinks the world isn't the way it should be, and she tells Risa what's wrong with everyone else between drags on her cigarettes. Another goddamn human interest story, she says, poking her yellow fingers at the television. A local channel is chronicling the life of an AIDS patient who has been kind enough to let them film him dying. No interest to me, goddamn faggots. Risa knows these are dirty words, at least goddamn and probably faggots, from the way Evie spits them out. Harsh language to use in front of a child, but nobody would ever tell Evie what to say or not say. Risa is unconcerned, as the words are ugly to her ears, and she will not repeat them. Grandpa Victor Mills, Evie's husband of 32 years, died from lung cancer before Risa was born. Evie maintains it was the drinking water. She does not keep pictures of him in the house, perhaps because she thinks all men are bastards, especially Risa's father. He was a real bastard, mistreating Irene, though Risa doesn't remember him ever raising his voice or his hand to her mother. She remembers her father as a gentleman. She does not question her grandmother. Evie doesn't let Risa play with any children in the neighborhood. She says their parents are all illegal and can't speak English, so why would Risa want to play with them anyway? Canasta is more fun, Evie says, though Risa has never gotten the knack of the game and always finds an excuse not to play. One time, when Risa was dressing a Barbie knockoff Oscar had given her, he found it in the recycle bin, Evie told Risa never to spread her legs for a bastard like her father. Risa had never spread her legs for anyone but Dr. Linda, and she looked at Evie with a lack of comprehension. Don't make me say it, Evie said, as if this could be done. Okay, Grandma. Fuck you, Evie said. There, are you satisfied? I said it. Don't let them fuck you. You're such a bright girl. Risa smelled the gin on her breath and realized it was not to be taken seriously. Grown-ups looked at Risa funny when she rode the city bus to school alone. She knew it wasn't just because she was pretty, with her long red hair and natural curls to her shoulders and the green eyes with flecks of yellow, her oval face with prominent chin, and the ease with which she smiled. They looked at her strangely because she was alone. This was doubly curious to her, because she assumed her aloneness and because, though she saw few others her age without escort, she thought it was supposed to be this way. She was not just a bright girl, but a big girl also. Irene told her each time she sent Risa to the corner bodega for milk or roach traps. Of course she wouldn't speak to strangers, that was a given. And of course she would look both ways before crossing the street, and if anything alarming ever happened, she would scream and run in the other direction. But to suggest she not move around alone in a city that requires moving around was just silly. Her father's mother's name was Catherine. She died in a large house when Risa's father was a teenager. He spoke lovingly of her in a quiet voice Risa knew was not meant to be heard by Irene. It seemed that nobody really liked anybody across the family lines. Evie said hard, critical things about John. Irene referred to Catherine as a lunatic and said John's problems were her fault and he should stop thinking about her after all these years the bitch is dead. Give it up already. John, however, kept his dislike and his meanness, if he had any, to himself. Risa thinks she is like her father in this respect. She doesn't always have nice thoughts, but she keeps her tongue flat behind her teeth and her judgments to herself. She made her way home from Grandma Evie's on Saturday. Evie was asleep on the couch with the television blaring, and once again Risa had kept her from burning to death by catching the cigarette that fell from Evie's fingers before it could start a fire. She was glad to be out of the house, even if she couldn't say goodbye. You did not wake Evie up from a sound sleep any more than you stuck a knife in a toaster. The subway stop was 3 blocks away. This allowed her to wave at the neighbors and say hello to the mailwoman. For this alone, she thought it was worth a trip to Grandma's. It restored her faith in people. She thinks most people are basically nice and just want to say hello and have you wave back, but something keeps them from it, especially in the city, where everyone hurries whether they need to or not. When she got back to the apartment, her mother's friend Rick was eating pancakes at the kitchen table. Rick gave rock and roll guitar lessons for a living and never seemed to be around when Risa's father was alive. His duffel bag was on the floor with its contents of socks, underwear, shirts, and blue jeans folded neatly in piles on top of it. "Where's Daddy?" Risa said, eyeing the clothes with the suspicion they'd be put in a drawer soon to stay. Irene turned the kitchen faucet on full, as if she hadn't heard her daughter and didn't want to. Rick poured more syrup on his pancakes. Risa had been told many times not to repeat herself, that "I heard you the first time," and that it was both impolite and imprudent to ask the same question twice. Keeping this in mind, she shrugged and went looking for her father in the living room. She knew right away something was different. The pictures of Grandma Catherine and Risa's Uncle Chip, who died in the Gulf War when a supply truck accidentally ran over him, were missing from the bookshelf. Gone, too, were the books her father read about life after death, near-death experiences, and angels. The 3 shelves he took for himself were empty, occupied now only by thin manuals on heavy metal chord progressions and marketing for rock musicians. She went to the coat closet and looked in the corner for the box her father kept containing coins his father had collected before he ran away. Quarters and dimes, mostly, a few Indian head nickels. Trash, Irene had called it. Stupid, useless trash. But her father had kept it all his life because he thought it was worth something. Not money, surely, but something, some emotional connection to a man who disappeared as quickly, completely, and suddenly as had his son 3 days ago. The box was not there. Risa decided she must discuss these events with Francis. He was the pigeon who'd resisted Irene's attempts to cripple him with a broom and who'd become Risa's best friend over the last few weeks. He was a smart bird, named by Risa after St. Francis, who loved animals. And even though Risa knew birds couldn't talk and she was too old for these things, she befriended him. She would wait until Irene was gone and take a piece of bread to the window. He'd be watching from somewhere, the ledge of another building maybe, and without fail he would fly to the fire escape outside their kitchen window and meet her. She recognized him from both the deliberate way he looked at her, his head tilted for a clear view, and from the single white feather on his otherwise gray left wing. He ate from her hand, and when she spoke to him, he cooed. Not dumbly, not randomly, but in a pattern that led her to believe quite firmly he was responding to what she said. She told Francis that her father had gone somewhere, possibly the East 30s, and she needed his help to find him. Could he ask his bird friends if they'd seen anything? Francis cooed, pecked at the crust from the bread in Risa's hand, and flew off. He would help her, she knew. How he would tell her what he found out was another matter, but she believed she could count on him. Rick and Irene took up residence in the bedroom. They were not sleeping. This Risa knew from the sounds that came through the wall. She hadn't heard these sounds in many months, and then only occasionally when her father was not sad and her mother was not sour. It was a rare combination, like a rainbow in an otherwise clouded sky. Her father had been sad a lot. Her mother yelled at him for it and called him lazy and said he was just like your mother, though he was not in a large house and had never, to Risa's knowledge, received shock treatments. She didn't know what shock treatment was, but assumed it had something to do with electricity, as Irene would occasionally torment her husband by coming up behind him, placing her hands on each side of his head, and making a terrible bzzz sound. Risa tried to cheer him up with games, and even told him shortly before his disappearance about Francis. "He'll come for you, Daddy," she said. "He likes you. I can tell by the way he watches you." John had not dismissed his daughter as silly or too imaginative, but had simply been too tired that day, having spent a week so sad he couldn't work, and had told Risa he'd meet Francis the next time. There never was a next time. Now it was weeks later, and John had flown the coop and Rick had brought his guitars over, and Risa was increasingly afraid she'd never have the chance to introduce her father to the pigeon. She began hearing things almost immediately. At first, people stopped talking when she came by, lowering their voices or dropping the conversation altogether. Oscar wouldn't look at her, and Miss Gandrich, who taught deaf children, just smiled at her with her head cocked as if Risa were one of her students. She caught snatches of words, whispers drawn back quickly at the sight of her. Breakdown, she heard, and crazy. Medication and psyche ward, as in, he should have been on a psyche ward. She resented people thinking she was too young to understand. She had always known what troubled her father. John Whitman was a very sad man. It was that simple. He saw things other people didn't, and Risa had long suspected that if anyone knew where all the missing people were, it was her father. The man saw angels. He read books about life after death because he saw ghosts, sometimes on the fire escape or in the laundry room when he was there by himself, and other times in their very own living room. He once pointed out a dead man to Risa during a commercial for feminine napkins. Risa couldn't see him, over by the coat closet, her father said. But she sensed someone, she knew she did, and she absolutely believed her father. The problem was that so many dead people were not happy or peaceful. They badgered him sometimes with requests and complaints, and it was only a matter of time before it drove him insane. Just as unsettling, he saw people's hearts, living people, everyday neighbors and strangers. "I see their hearts," he once told Risa. "And you know what?" "What, Daddy?" "Most of them are broken. Some of them are just cracked a little. They'll last for years until one day something happens and they just cave in. Others, I don't know how these people keep moving." "What's my heart look like?" she'd said, looking up at him, convinced he could see beneath her ribs. He answered her by crying. She hated to see him cry, and she thought her heart must be in pretty bad shape to bring this on. She leaned her head on his shoulder and told him everything would be all right. After a month, Risa stopped looking for her father to come home. The police came by two or three nights a week answering complaints from neighbors about Rick's guitar playing. Risa thought it was peculiar the man could teach what he played so terribly, trying to disguise his lack of skill by turning his amplifier up until the windows trembled with the noise. Irene ignored it, talking on the phone or making brownies while Rick plucked and strummed and often attacked the frets on his imitation Fender Stratocaster. "They're just jealous," Rick said when the police left, referring to the neighbors. "They hate me because I'm going to be a star." Irene: "I love you." Rick: "It's all for you, baby. You'll be famous too. I won't let them put my picture in Rolling Stone without you next to me." Irene would smile then and kiss his neck, as if Risa weren't sitting on the floor watching I Love Lucy with the sound turned down because Rick thought the actress was a hag. Risa knew the man would never be a star. Not like her father, whom she'd decided at this point was already twinkling in the heavens. She looked for him above the city lights, but only two or three stars could be seen above the reflection of New York City. She wanted Francis to point her father out to her, if she could just get the bird to show up at night. It was a hopeless cause. Irene and Rick were there after sundown, and Francis was no fool. Tomorrow was not the eternity for Risa, it was for most children. If anything, the sunset came too soon, bringing with it darkness and the absence of her father's voice. Though he had laughed less and less, it was that rich timbre she'd found most comforting in life, the sound of a good guffaw from John's throat bouncing happily off the walls. The only laughter she heard now was the shrill staccato cackle of Irene overreacting to one of Rick's jokes, and of course, Rick laughing at himself. There was nothing genuine to any of it, the sounds of their voices ringing as hollow as the lies they told her. "Daddy left us," Irene said when Risa dared to ask of his whereabouts a second and third time. "He didn't love us." "But he'll call, won't he?" Risa said. "How many times do I have to tell you? He hates us. Rick's your father now." Rick would never be her father. She'd decided on that. He was a skinny, nervous man who didn't even like children. As for her real father, she knew he couldn't hate her. She knew he would break doors down and move mountains and stop subway trains in their tracks to be by her side at a time like this. She began to suspect they'd done something to him, locked him in a chest, or put him in jail on false charges. She asked Oscar one day how much it would cost to hire a private detective.
"Lose something," he said,
hiding his broken teeth with his hand, as was his habit.
"My dad."
He mumbled something about it being much too expensive for a little girl, the sentence trailing off in babble as he turned and limped away, his bad knee giving him trouble again. She went to Mrs. Gandrich next, asking if she could use the phone to call an investigator she'd found in the Yellow Pages. "What is it you're investigating?" Mrs. Gandrich said, blocking the door with her body as she always did, giving rise to the rumors she kept her late husband's corpse in the kitchen. Someone had seen a man there through the window, but nothing had been verified. "I think my father's been abducted," Risa said, putting on her best pleading face. "Where'd you learn a word like that?" "Pardon?" "Talk to your mother," the brittle old woman said, slamming the door on Risa. She didn't have any money, and she couldn't get anyone to help her. What's more, Irene had decided that John could not be spoken of in the house anymore, as if he never existed, as if he never had a wife and a daughter and a home on 19th Street and a job delivering packages to anxious people. Risa obeyed her mother. She stopped asking questions. She pretended to be satisfied with all the things she had not been told. And she slept with one ear cocked for the sound of her father's return, trying her mightiest not to despair as the weeks turned into months. But she did despair. He was never coming back. She knew that now. It was not his fault. Something terrible had overwhelmed him. He had seen one too many ghosts, or a heart broken so badly he could only stare at its pieces, feeling helpless. That was, Risa knew, how he felt most of the time. And in her bed at night, trying not to let it get the best of her, she began to understand in a new way, to feel as he had felt all his life, to be her father's daughter. It was Evie in the end who told Risa what happened. She'd been babysitting her granddaughter while Irene and Rick went to a rock concert. A report was on the news about gun control and how the police and the governor and just about anyone with any sense was in favor of it. Evie did not have sense, and she hissed at the television screen. "Fucking liberals," she said between sips of gin that Risa was supposed to think was iced tea. "If it wasn't for guns, your father, that bastard, would still be around making your mother's life miserable." Evie's concern for her daughter always struck Risa as strange, as Irene had nothing but contempt for the old woman and only kept the relationship cordial because she wanted the house when Evie died. "Guns?" Risa said, not seeing the connection between a news report and her father becoming a star above Manhattan. "He blew his brains out. Hasn't anybody told you that?" Risa knew what this meant, blew his brains out. She knew it meant her father had put a gun in his mouth or up against his temple and pulled the trigger. She stared at her grandmother for a full 30 seconds until the woman, in a rare display of decorum, blushed bright red. "You're such a bright girl," Evie said. "Such a big girl. I thought somebody told you." Risa excused herself, went into the bathroom, and curled up against the toilet. She did not come out until morning. She never said anything to her mother. She assumed Irene would think, like Evie, that someone else had told her. The only person she spoke to for the next 2 weeks was Francis. He seemed unhappy, too, and he would stop to visit her only briefly, pecking at the bread she offered him before flying off to another ledge or down to the sidewalk. She thought maybe his father died also, or that he fell in love with a girl pigeon who didn't love him back. These things happened,
like her father blowing his brains out between episodes of a situation comedy. One morning, while Irene was on the phone shrieking at the insurance company that refused to pay on a suicide, Risa went to the window and looked for Francis. Winter was coming, and she wanted to ask him if there was anything she could do to make it easier for him. He'd been by every day at the same time, and she stuck her head out the window calling his name softly so Irene wouldn't hear. But he didn't come, not then or an hour later or an hour after that. The next morning, she had to go to the corner for milk for Rick's granola. She put on her coat and went down the four flights of stairs to the street, walked outside and down the steps. There, by the crumbling pillar at the bottom of the stoop, lay Francis, perfectly preserved and dead, as if he'd stopped to think about something and fallen over. No marks of a cat, no automotive trauma, just a dead pigeon on the sidewalk. Risa stared down at him a moment. No one buried anything but their memories in New York City. The thought of a ceremony didn't occur to her. She bent down and gently plucked the white feather from his wing. She waved at the carcass, sighed, and walked up toward the market. There was nothing to be said. Francis was dead, and her father was dead. Irene wanted the milk immediately, as Rick would be back soon from another failed audition. Oscar painted a vacant apartment on the second floor. Grandma Evie was going to Las Vegas on Sunday to smoke and gamble and hate everything. Risa opened her memory box and put Francis's wing there, along with all the other things she might want to remember someday, like the sound of her father's laughter and the gold-plated medal with the tri-colored ribbon she'd seen in the stairwell. She walked toward the corner. A car honked at an old man crossing against the light with his walker, just as Risa let the feather slide from her fingers, thinking she would have to get a bigger box someday. The end. This has been the audio edition of Memory Box, written by Mark McNeese, narrated and produced by Wondervox AI. Copyright Mademark Publishing.